Welcome to Upfront, the podcast. I'm Katie Hannan. As we record this today, almost 33,000 Palestinians have been killed. Most of those are women and children. Many thousands more are maimed. Those who have managed to survive have likely lost their homes and are now facing a famine. Dr. Morgan McMonagall is an Irish vascular and trauma surgeon who returned to Waterford University Hospital from Gaza less than 5 weeks ago. While there, he worked with other foreign doctors and local medics treating injured Palestinians in a field hospital near Rafah. He had fully intended to go back. Now, he's not so sure. Dr. Morgan McMonagall, you're very welcome to Upfront, the podcast.
Thank you very much, Katie.
I am actually really fascinated by how a doctor from Waterford University Hospital ends up taking shrapnel and bullets out of people in one of the most dangerous places on earth right now, but we will circle back to that. Can I first get your response, though, to that shocking incident where those aid workers from World Central Kitchen were attacked and killed? What's your sense of it? I know I was listening to Jose Andres, the founder of World Central Kitchen, today. He's saying his aid workers were targeted systematically, car by car.
Yeah, first of all, it's absolutely shocking. And obviously, you know, our condolences and our heartfelt sympathies go out to the families, you know, of the victims who selflessly gave their time and their expertise and energies to a crisis. I guess we don't really know the facts, and that's always in any conflict situation. People can delay any process by saying we don't know the facts and we have to investigate. And meanwhile, time keeps on ticking by and tragedies continue to happen. I don't know if they were systematically targeted. But what I would say is even if the intention wasn't there to target them particularly, I would suspect, like in any conflict situation, that the behavior was so reckless, even if it wasn't your primary intention to start with. When I arrived, we were part of what was considered a deconflicted zone. So, you know, Gaza is a small area. You know, it's not the size of Ukraine. It's a small area. People knew where we were. We would phone it in via the United States and via the IDF whenever we had a convoy moving. For example, when I went from Rafah to the base hospital, which is about a 40-minute drive, and back again, people knew, and we were, you know, informed or reassured that we would be protected. But you're always going to be at the mercy of human error. And human error is something that, even with the best will in the world, always exists somewhere in the background, and you mitigate as best as possible. Nevertheless, it doesn't take away from the fact that innocent people were killed and are still being killed. Before I went out to Gaza, I was reassured somewhat by some of my mentors who had been there that no foreign aid workers had been hurt or killed thus far. And now that's changed.
We should say, of course, because a huge number of aid workers have died, just not the foreign aid workers. There had been some sense that foreign aid workers had some semblance of extra protection. Can you just talk me through, though, Morgan, because I'm really interested in that, because we were hearing that they had coordinated this convoy of aid workers from World Central Kitchen, where, as you say, like you were in a deconflicted zone, and that they had coordinated their movements with the IDF. And just step by step, because this is not just you make a phone call in the morning and you're kind of looked after for the day. Just talk me through exactly how much coordination goes into any movement, because you would have been in Gaza under very similar protocols to this aid team.
I mean, no agency wants to have on their record that they lost foreign aid workers. So everything's very carefully coordinated. These NGOs are doing this. They are highly professional people who are very well connected politically and structurally and logistically. So before I even went, my name along with other names would have been on a list for the Egyptian authorities, for the Israeli Defense Forces, with the Gazan authorities also. So every single foreign worker who entered Gaza is on a record And similarly, if you needed to get out quickly, there are protocols in place and logistics in place. Once I landed in our deconflicted zone, I wasn't allowed to leave, but we had some other personnel who did leave as part of a convoy to look at other sites for potential hospital setups or field hospitals. And it would have been carefully coordinated. I always say in a situation like this, the most important people are not the doctors and the nurses. The most important people are security and your logistics.
I do feel a bit uncomfortable talking about these foreign deaths as if they're somehow different to all the other, obviously, tens of thousands of deaths that have already taken place and the, 180 or 190 deaths of local aid workers that have died. But I think we are talking about it because it does look set to have a massive impact on the whole foreign aid network that, of course, right now is Gaza's lifeline. We know World Central Kitchen was responsible for 60% of the non-governmental aid going in there. Another American charity, Near East Refugee Aid, they were also working closely with World Central Kitchen. They are also now freezing their operations. We know that aid ships have turned back. And as I said in the introduction there, you had been planning, actively planning going back. And this has also, made you think twice.
Well, again, it's made me certainly pause and think about how risky is it getting that now that there seems to be, again, based on what we're reading in the media and seeing on TV, that there seems to be a divergence of American opinion now and Israeli opinion. And now that the conflict seems to be contaminating other Islamic countries, I guess one has to consider is it going to be far too dangerous for anybody to enter, that there will be no guaranteed protections or at least somewhat reassured of protections going in. So it certainly would make me think twice. I wouldn't say absolutely no. I would be careful about when and how I went in and what agency I went in with. But again, you're absolutely right in what you said at the outset, that we're talking about it because some foreign aid workers died. And there have been many, many other workers for other NGOs who are nationals of the Gaza Strip who have died. And we all go in very aware of protocols that if there is a sudden massive crisis that we have to evacuate, the nationals are left behind. They cannot leave, which is hard. It's absolutely hard. They are human beings with dignity as well. And even when we were taken out early, I was taken out. We were evacuated early because we were expecting a ground invasion ahead of Ramadan. It was hard leaving some really good, decent people behind because you're leaving them behind in a war zone that is about to become worse. And that is definitely a hard thing to do.
Yeah, and I know you're in contact and there's a network of people like yourselves who go in and out of these very dangerous places and, do what you can for the time you're there. Do you think you will? You're not alone, I imagine, in reevaluating whether it's possible to go back to Gaza now.
Yeah, I've spoken with a few people, and some are definitely going back. Some people feel that maybe, as a result of the tragedy this week, that more care will be taken with regards to foreign aid workers. But this conflict is so fluid; it changes on a day by day basis, and. I have reasonable information to believe that the regular Israeli military are becoming very fatigued with the process. So mistakes can be made, and I think mistakes will continue to be made. And that's the big fear.
When you say that you've reasonable information that the IDF are becoming fatigued, that's just battle weary and careless, is it?
Well, I think so. I think any conflict that drags on, again, this is my opinion, any conflict that drags on where there's no end in sight, I think anybody can become weary.
Can we go back to when you were there yourself then and just describe to us again the conditions that you were working in then? Is it a hospitainer? Is that the term?
Yeah, hospitainer is basically like a very large articulated lorry that you see them on any motorway, transporting goods. So basically the back container is reconfigured into an operating room that you can bring a patient in and put a ventilator and anesthetic equipment in. But it's still very tight on space. It's quite claustrophobic. There's no windows. It's better than operating in a tent in case there's an explosion and shrapnel flies through the compound, it will protect you from a certain element of that. And we worked in those conditions in the heat. Now, I was there in February. It was cold at nighttime. During the day, it might hit 21, 22 degrees. So although it was reasonably warm, it's going to be really, really difficult to work in those conditions from here on in with the gas and summer coming in. Occasionally, an explosion would go off and you'd hear it. A lot of the time, you'd feel it. Occasionally, the entire hospital would rock. So you'd get a certain idea of how close that explosion or how big that explosion might have been. And we continue to work under those conditions. You take the patients out. Generally, family will help take the patients in and out. It's not like a regular hospital where it's staff only. We needed to use family as well for that. And we rotated on a constant basis like that, operating next, operating next, operating next.
And even though you were in a deconflicted zone, you were close enough to explosions to actually have the container rattle?
Yeah, I mean, we were roughly halfway between Khan Yunis and Rafah, a little bit closer to Rafah. And although the military hadn't, from what I believe, hadn't been on the ground in Rafah, there were still targets being hit, including some buildings close by. I believe there was military within 500 metres of our compound. And again, you're very close to it. We're deconflicted, but you're still relying on human error. And there's a potential that a high value target, for want of, and I apologize for using military parlance, but with the way things were going, that you just don't know what the next intention might be of the next strike. And you'd certainly hear gunfire on the ground, constant drones overhead. Occasionally you'd hear missiles that had a certain sound. And from some of my security advisors, they advise us that they are from the Navy ships. Occasionally helicopters and a lot of air fighters going overhead as well, because there's no civilian aircraft.
Yeah. Tell me, did the targeting of the Al Shifa hospital have a big impact on the medical community in Gaza?
Yeah, the big raid was there the day before I arrived, and they, within the few days after that, because they couldn't get anybody out, it was essentially in lockdown, and the hospital is now became non-functioning very quickly. So we took, over the following 3 days or so, we took quite a sizable number of patients from that hospital, mostly the trauma patients, and we had to erect numerous marquees. We managed to get emergency funding in very quickly, and the United Nations delivered some marquees to create more space for patients to come in, and we took a lot of the patients from there. So you've now got Khan Yunis and the largest hospital in the region, because the hospital in Rafah is small. It's about 200 beds. It doesn't take trauma. It doesn't have a functioning emergency room. It does a certain amount of obstetrics and medicine, general medicine. So that is in no way capable of taking, not only space-wise, but skills-wise, would not have the wherewithal and the rigor accoutrements for that. So we took as much as we could, and the rest of the people are just, who knows where they are. And it's not only traumas, but you have to remember, like 6 months into, when I was there, it was almost 4 months, you've also got what we call neglected disease. So regular things like cancer and diabetes and kidney failure, none of that has been taken care of. Obstetrics, I mean, whether we like it or not, children are going to be born, and they have to be born somewhere. And you know, we were struggling. It did feel like we were just bailing out an ocean with a bucket sometimes.
But even apart from that, and I'll come back to that because that's really important, but the psychological impact of seeing a hospital targeted in that way, you know, the reason given was that, as you said, because it came into my head there when you said about if a high value target happened to wander past your hospitainer, you know, would that draw fire onto you? Did that have an impact, I'm thinking, on doctors in Gaza?
Yes, it's always in the back of your mind. When you're in a situation like this, nobody sleeps properly, even with the best will in the world. Nobody really sleeps properly. So it's always in the back of your mind, and you do have security advisors who, with the best will in the world, keep an eye out. But, you know, if you start labeling people as terrorists, you know, There was a time when everyone with an Irish accent going to Britain was potentially a terrorist. And we know that's not true and that's not correct. So it's lazy just to label every man, you know, who as the enemy. And I think that maybe we saw a lot of teenagers injured, because that's what teenagers do. They go out after dark. People are not just bored, they're bored as well as everything else. They're going to do what they can. They're scrabbling for food, they're scrabbling for energy, for cars. There's a black market economy has grown up. So inflation is absolutely massive. Like a liter of petrol, I believe before the war started, was approximately the same as it is here. It was like, you know, €2. It's now about €12, equivalent, maybe $12. The best way to transport things around, I was informed, is no longer a car, because there's no way to fill the cars with fuel. They were using cooking oil. Cars break down. But it was a donkey. And I believe a donkey cost $5,000 in Gaza now. It certainly was when I was there in February, because that's how everything was in dollars. Everything was black market value. So when you push any human group into a situation like that, they have to survive. I mean, the instinct for survival is so strong. They are going to go out to get food for their family, clothing, fuel to light fires, because it's cold at nighttime. It was sub-zero sometimes. And therefore, you're a target after dark. And that was one of the reasons why the Red Crescent would not transport patients after dark. It was just too dangerous.
And the kind of trauma patients that you were being presented with, give me some sense of what was it, everything? Like what was coming to you?
From our trauma, general surgery and trauma point of view, it was a lot of blast injuries, so a lot of limbs missing, a lot of shrapnel. So if you're very close to a blast of military magnitude, you're going to die. If you survive the building falling and don't die, chances are you're outside the immediate epicenter of the explosion, but you're at the mercy of shrapnel. And shrapnel is any piece of sharp metal that just goes in all directions. And the commonest injury was actually shrapnel attempted to go through the chest and then through the abdomen in one go. So you'd have a massive lung injury that you'd have to operate on, and usually a massive liver injury and or bowel. And you'd take care of all of it in one go. A lot of gunshot wounds, a lot of sniper activity. You'd know by the size of the bullet you removed. I mean, I worked in Philadelphia, where the 9mm handgun is very, 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 very commonly used. But in Gaza, it was large, 12mm heavy, probably, you know, like a sniper's type rifle.
And did you have the means to deal with that in the field hospital? I mean, did you have enough anesthesia? Did you have enough equipment? Like what kind of...
Well, we had the skills. Most of our anesthetists were Gazan anesthesiologists and anesthetists. They were very good, but we didn't have the same level of sophisticated equipment and drugs that you would have in a Western hospital. We ran out of some types of anesthesia drugs in the first few days, managed to get some replenishments. We ran out of muscle relaxants. Muscle relaxants are often used in major surgery to keep the patient completely still. We had the surgical skills, but we might run out of simple dressings, simple gowns to prep the patient's abdomen. We just about had enough gloves, sterile gloves to operate with. And we only had two ventilators for the two operating rooms that we had. So you come in for major surgery, you're put asleep, obviously, but then every single patient has to be woken up. That would never, ever happen in a Western hospital. A patient would be brought to the intensive care unit on the ventilator, and they would be gently woken up once everything was corrected, like your biochemistry and your blood transfusion, and make sure everything's done properly. A bit like landing a plane, you want to, you know, have your entire plan go to form. But that wasn't the case. There was a lot of fly by the seat of your pants a little bit. So almost every patient was like a pilot hitting a storm or hitting an unexpected emergency, and you had to do a workaround. You had to make critical decisions all the time in the operating room.
What was the profile of the patients you were seeing? What kind of age?
Certainly male victims were of a higher volume, and that's probably the nature of any conflict, that men tend to be the ones out in the field more. especially in an Islamic country where women tend to stay home, look after children. But we had a lot of children, limbs missing, lower limb, upper limb, who had amazing spirits. I mean, some of the children brought in, once they were repaired, missing one or two limbs. We had one child had three limbs gone, one upper limb, two lower limbs from blast injuries. It's amazing how children can bounce back with great spirit, you know, and we can call it lack of understanding. We can call it, you know, a childlike wonderment, but it's amazing how they recovered and still managed to be children. Children, one thing I've learned from being around the world is children are always children. Children want to play, children want to interact, children want to do children things, no matter how bad things get. But you sometimes look at the child lying there with two lower limbs missing that you've managed to save their life, and you wonder, what kind of a life am I sending this child back to? Because they're forever going to be disabled, especially if you lose an upper limb, because we use our upper limbs to work. Lower limbs are mostly for locomotion. But you're sending them back to an environment that's pretty much destroyed. It's a culture where children tend to look after parents as they get older. That's no longer the case if their parents are still alive. And if they're not, it's going to be the reverse. They can't contribute to the economy. They can't contribute to themselves. So you're looking at a country with a generation for the next, you know, 30, 40 years on its knees, essentially, that's going to find it so difficult to get back to any level of human dignity.
I just wonder, and I know you have children of your own, when you see a child being brought in on a trolley to you in that condition, I mean, does it hit you? How do you get beyond, you know, a natural human reaction to what you're faced with there?
Certainly, deep down, of course, you feel you feel a certain sense of oh my godness, and a certain sense of anger that we could allow this to happen. That the world, when I say we, I mean the world, can allow this to happen. But you do tend to bury it. You do tend to go into professional mode to do your very best. But it is hard. It is hard with the children and young teenagers, young female teenagers who were doing nothing other than being at home, minding the home and their parents, and they're hit with a bomb. So it does... Nothing surprises me anymore of man's cruelty to man. And I don't use the word man organically in the mankind sense. I mean man's cruelty to man, because that's what it is. It's a political problem started by men. So it's a political solution.
In terms of then the you mentioned starvation there, and obviously we're hearing really scarifying stories about and seeing some really, really distressing video of children. Did you see that? Did you see that developing? As you say, you're out of there, what, just about 5 weeks now. What were you seeing before you left in terms of people's condition?
Yeah, so we were, our deconflicted compound, our field hospital, was reasonably lucky. We had food coming in, certainly in February, coming into the compound. So if patients came, they would get fed as well. That was a nice thing about our unit. Not only were you treated, you also got fed and watered and had your clothes cleaned. We had a laundry service, so patients would have their clothes cleaned. But when I came back and I spoke with RTE then, I did say that Gaza was on the brink of famine, like literally on the brink then. While a lot of other world reports were saying Gaza is at risk in the future, but Gaza was already on the brink when I left. And now people are using that word, they're on the brink of famine. I have no doubt Gaza is in famine. Absolutely no doubt whatsoever.
Why do you say that?
Well, when I was leaving, we were seeing patients come in who were clearly malnourished, both protein and calorie malnourishment. So they're losing weight to a dangerous degree. Now, we can distort the picture by trying to define famine. Is it X percentage of people need to be malnourished? Is it a certain percentage of your body weight you need to lose? The bottom line is famine is where there are a significant percentage of the population who are at risk of dying from a lack of food. That is, in very simple subjective terms, a significant proportion of the population is at risk of dying from a lack of food. something that would never happen in Gaza in peace times. They were reasonably self-sufficient, and something that should not, absolutely should not be seen in today's world. And you're talking about a population of about 2.5 million, 3 million people in an area roughly the size of Manhattan who can't get out. They're walled in. They are walled in and they are starving. And the world can see this happening. I think it behoves everyone. Forget about who's at fault for the war. Let's talk about who's now responsible for a solution. And I think we're all responsible for a solution.
Just to circle back again on how you ended up there. And you mentioned Philadelphia there because you definitely didn't learn how to take shrapnel out of lungs in Waterford. I hope you didn't anyway. Is that where you got your main trauma training?
I was in Australia first. I worked in trauma in Australia in Sydney. I did a lot of pre-hospital care, did a lot of helicopter retrieval work. So saw a lot of general trauma, but certainly going and working in Philadelphia, I had some of the best mentors in the world who trained me. Philadelphia, like most large urban centers in America, the 9mm handgun is a very attractive pastime for a lot of young men. And the thing about 9mm handgun is, you'll often survive being shot with 9mm because it doesn't carry the same amount of velocity or inertial energy as a larger rifle. So certainly got a lot of training, 5 to 8 gunshots a night, busy night 12 to 15 going forward. That would be typical of a large urban center in North America. So I got a lot of experience dealing with gunshot wounds in the United States that I then brought back to London when I was part of the trauma service there. And then, one of the nice things about living in Europe is not only are our human rights and civil rights, and I think people forget this, that Europe, compared to the rest of the world, our human and civil rights are far, far more advanced than most other countries in the world.
I know you did also see a lot of action in London in your time in London there, and you treated some of the victims. And I think, am I right, did you treat the attacker in the Westminster?
Yeah, I was actually in St. Mary's Hospital when the Westminster Bridge attack went off. So I treated a lot of the victims, and I pronounced the Westminster Bridge attacker dead when he came in, as well as managing a lot of the other victims of the Westminster Bridge. And that was, it was nice to see. When I say nice, I don't mean it's nice to see this happen ever, but it was nice to see a hospital system, an advanced hospital system that I was part of, actually kick into action and actually able to contain a situation, albeit in a minute form compared to what's happening in Gaza, but still with the right system in place, and with the pre-hospital care workers and the police and the hospital system working in unison and together in partnership, it's nice to see it work very well. And the same at Grenfell, I was on for the Grenfell fire as well. Same thing happened there as well, and that the hospital system really worked. Once you take a hospital system out, and this is maybe is one of the problems with a situation like Gaza, is that when you lose your hospitals, then you lose your epicenter of safety. You lose that safety net where people can go for treatment, where people are actually, the workers who are your best asset in any situation are all there for exactly the same purpose, and to treat the victims of whatever disaster has happened.
Can I ask you, and I'm conscious that you are possibly going to be back in this zone again yourself, but just in terms of, and I know you say you're not at all political and you don't want to talk at all about who's responsible for what's going on there. I'm just wondering, is there politics talked about in the middle of this in on the ground in Gaza now, and this sense, is there any sense that there is anybody running the show there? Is Hamas actually, is there any sense of Hamas being there in the background?
I certainly didn't see it. I would say that Gaza is right now, and certainly when I was there, and it's gotten worse since because I'm still in contact with some people, things have become so destabilized, and so it has degenerated so much that there is no real proper sovereign law and order. The hospitals are struggling. It's NGOs are propping it up. The police force is almost non-existent as far as I could see. There was a sort of a ragtaggle security element in Rafah when we were driving through it just to keep people somewhat in order off the roads while trucks were driving by or cars, maybe to stop some people stealing. There's no sanitation. That's not being repaired. There's no running water. Buildings aren't being repaired. So people are essentially being left to on the very edge of survival to just make do. And it's going to be, I hate to use the term, survival of the fittest. If you survive, that's fine. But it's a case of numbers now, and numbers are dying on a daily basis. So on one side, you have an enormous military alliance. And on the other side, you basically have a population of civilians who have nowhere to turn. They have nowhere to turn for food, water, and they're barely being able to turn towards healthcare now because the health NGOs are now really struggling to maintain the service they want to bring.
Is there anger at Hamas on the ground there that they brought this upon them by that October 7 attack?
It was never
attack?
Really discussed, to be honest. Certainly not with patients or people. It was never mentioned. And, you know, I think that what has happened since then is so overwhelming. Like, if you think about it, and no right-minded person would ever condone what happened on October 7th. It was an absolute, you know, atrocity. But and any sovereign country has an absolute right to defend itself. But at what point does defense become offense? And something like that's always going to be fact and degree. It's always going to be looked at the facts and a degree of offense. And I think any right-minded person can see what has happened since then is so disproportionate and so unreasonable that nobody could ever... I can't believe even the hardest right-wing person from Israel could even approve of what's happened at a human level, you know, at a human dignity level.
I do think there is, that the war is still very popular, even though Netanyahu mightn't be that popular on the ground. I think the war cause is still popular, is what we're hearing from Israel. Can I ask, though, about yourself, though, in terms of what is it in you that you know, you're that most of us run away from this or even can find it difficult to look at it? But what is it in people like you that run towards the fire rather than away from it?
I suppose at a certain age, well, first of all, you need to have, you know, the skill base and the experience built up over time. I've had a few doctors come to me, and nurses actually, come to me and say they would like to be involved in something like this. So I do think those type of people do exist out there. A sense of purpose, I think, is very important. I know there's lots of ways to express your purpose in life, but I suppose when you become a surgeon, you become a trauma surgeon, you do seek out where you can use your skills the most, whether it's in an urban environment in North America or in Europe. And in this case, I decided to go to Ukraine and then Gaza. And I've had some very good mentors over the years who have been in similar situations and have come back reasonably unscathed, who I would hold in very high esteem. So I suppose some itches just have to be scratched. And I'd like to think I have a good sense of right and wrong. And I have a profound interest in human rights and human dignity. And I think a combination in a conflict zone, you get a combination of using your surgical skills and some humanitarian advocacy. I think the two go very, very well together. And this was a perfect opportunity to exercise and express that.
You mentioned there your mentors that came back relatively unscathed. And I mean, I was very taken with Fergal Keane's documentary where he was very open about the PTSD and the hangover that he's dealing with now from his years witnessing what he witnessed around the world. Do you feel unscathed so far, or do you have moments where you think this mightn't be doing my head?
Yeah, I'm not blinded or unaware of the potential personal dangers and even personal long term risk. I do know Fergal. I've met Fergal, and I've read three of his books, and his latest one, The Madness, was superbly written, and I think it helps. It actually helps to read his story, and I hope if Fergal hears his podcast that will be reassuring for him, because I do think it helps very much reading his story, and I hope he goes on to help other people in a similar situation going forward. I do think times have changed slightly, and again, this is purely my opinion, in that what happened during Rwanda was on such a huge interpersonal scale, with people being murdered up close. And I know that shouldn't make a difference, but I think what certain journalists and media saw in Rwanda was so horrific that, certainly reading his book, that seems to have been an epicenter. Anyone in a difficult situation, I do believe that anybody who's gone through a force majeure in life, whether it's been in a conflict zone, or they've survived a fire or a car crash, or maybe some sort of criminal assault or sexual assault, you'll find that people find the most support amongst camaraderie. People who have a shared experience. You often hear about soldiers coming back from war. It's a shared experience that family, even your closest relatives, will never understand. It's one of the reasons why maybe alcoholics go to AA, or other victims go to other groups. It's that shared experience, that shared bond is very important. And I have found, like, I wouldn't have gone to Gaza on my own or with one or two people. I went with an organization that does wrap its arms around its people, that does provide supports. You develop a certain gallows humor when you're there, but everybody's in the trenches together. And I think that's the best, by far, the best support you can have. And if anybody was going out into any conflict situation, that would be the one thing. It's your team working, and your self-leadership within the team is kind of your best protection.
We are lucky to have people like yourselves who actually are willing to do that. I wish you all the very best, whether you go back or wherever else you find yourself. But for now, Morgan McMonagall, many thanks.
Thank you so much, Katie.
And that was Dr. Morgan McMonagall. Thanks for listening to Upfront, the podcast. If you want to get in touch with us, you can message us on social media at RTE Upfront or via WhatsApp. Our WhatsApp number is 087-677-1000. And don't forget to tune in to Upfront on Monday evenings. This Monday we'll be coming up after the news at 9:35 on RTE One. And you'll also catch us on the RTE Player. And I'll talk to you then.